Hello and welcome to QSO. I'm Ted Randall, and our guest today is John Cunningham, W1AI. And John is with Ham Test Online. And you'll say, what is that? Well, if you're thinking, even have the slightest inkling of getting into the hobby of ham radio, you need to know about Ham Test Online. Now, this is not an infomercial. We're not doing an infomercial. The reason why we're doing this radio show is basically because I happen to really believe in this hobby. I have all kinds of reasons as to why I believe in this hobby. And I have not found yet a system by which a person just walking on the street that knows nothing about radio or electronics, that has a desire to get a ham license, I know of no system that works any better than Ham Test Online. So that's why they're on the air. This is not a paid commercial. This is not an infomercial. It's just because I think I want everyone within the reach of this radio signal to be able to get a ham license if they really want to. I want to tell them about the probably the easiest method of doing that, the most painless method, and by the same token, the most fun. Because the folks that I know that have tried Ham Test Online have gone down the road, all have come away smiling. You know, got their ham license in their hand, and they said, God, this was fun. I enjoyed this. So anyways, I want to say hello to John Cunningham, and welcome on board to QSO. Now, John, what's your opinion today?
Okay, Dad. Well, thanks for that introduction. I just want to give you a fair warning here. I'm going to give you 20 minutes to knock it off, saying all those things about us.
Oh, he told me, he said, I hate it when somebody asks me a question, you know, it's kind of like a totally open-ended question, like, you know, what's your opinion about everything, you know?
About life, the universe, and everything. Well, I'd have to say that my answer is 42.
Oh, there you go.
I appreciate the kind words, you know, that you said, and I think, in a sense, I am very lucky that you know, people do use the product, and they do get their ham license, and then they come talk to me. And if there's ever a time that you want to talk to somebody, it's when they've just gone through some major, they've achieved something major, something that's, you know, it's not a trivial thing to get a ham license. I mean, I consider the technician exam itself to be somewhat of a throwaway exam. It's really not as hard as people think. But after you spent 10 or 20 hours studying for something, for anything, you know, it's still a pretty big accomplishment, but especially when people are getting upgrades to the extra. I think that's, you know, these people, it's like they're, you know, I think maybe they've been dosed with something. They're like nuclear radioactive, and that's when they're coming to me saying, this product was great and it really helped me. So I have to put up with this kind of stuff all day long, and it's sort of like, you know how they, hey, Ted, you know how dentists have the highest rates of suicide? I think it's because, you know, they hurt people. Well, I'm sort of in the opposite profession, I think.
Well, you know, I guess you were talking about the technician exam being a throwaway exam. But let me say something. If a person thinks they're going to walk in off the street and take that exam and pass it, they're kidding themselves. It's not going to happen.
I agree with you there.
No, it's not as difficult as the other levels of license. But it still requires study, and it still requires you to become familiar with the material. And this is a challenge for someone who is non-technical, somebody who knows nothing about you know, which end of the battery is positive. They know nothing about what a resistor is. They've never heard of Ohm's law. They don't know any of these things. This is all foreign to them, extremely foreign. And the thing about Ham Test Online is somehow the way the questions are programmed and the little diagrams and all the things that are there for you to look at and view and select from, the way that is set up, it takes you into that world step by step, and by repeating over and over things that you may not get until you finally get them. And it takes that person off the street with absolutely no background whatsoever. And eventually that person winds up with a technician license. So I think that, I think what it is, John, when you're in ham radio for any length of time, or in your commercial radio or something like that, and you're exposed to this stuff constantly, Then the various grades of license, it's like, for example, you look at the technician, you say, oh, well, that's really nothing. You know?
Right.
But for the guy walking on the street that has never, ever looked at a schematic diagram, doesn't have any idea what Ohm's law is or Kirchhoff's law, or has absolutely no idea what the difference is between voltage, current, resistance, and all that kind of stuff. You know, to them, I mean, it might as well be Greek, you know, and so... What I'm saying is Hemp Test Online has a method by which they take those people and you bring them in slowly and through review and exposing to new information as you continue to review, you bring them right in, you know, and by the time you get done, this friend of mine just completed the course and said that she was scoring 100% on the exams, and I think that she spent maybe 2 weeks at it, you know, but it was a committed 2 weeks,
yeah,
but you're talking about someone that says that all they're into is fingernail polish, you know. So I mean, she had no background at all. It's kind of funny to hear her talk about it. But anyhow, go ahead. Now that I've shot your theory down that the technician license is nothing whatsoever.
You got to understand, I'm a little bit biased. I'm a little bit skewed by what I see, which is I see people subscribing to the course, and they study for, there's quite a few people who only study for 5 or 6. I tell people give it 10 hours, so you'd be assured of passing, but I see people studying for 5, 6, 7 hours, and then they go take the exam, and they do very well on it. And so that sort of skews my perception as to make it seem like it's something that doesn't take a lot of work. Now, if you're a student who thinks that sitting down and studying for 5 or 6 hours for something is a huge amount of effort, well, then I don't know, maybe it's not a throwaway exam. But for me, I see people who get on and they study for 30, 40, 50, 60 hours for the extra, which is very difficult. And then when I see somebody who only studies for 5 hours and they get a perfect score, to my mind, that really makes the exam seem easy. And you know, you got to admit, it's a multiple choice exam. So for every question, there's going to be 4 answers. So if you don't even look at the exam page, but you just circle answers at random, you pick one answer for each question and turn it in, chances are you got a 25%. You only need 75% to pass the thing. So I mean, you really got a huge leg up. Just by the way the exam is structured. And there are people, I mean, you said people don't come in off the street and pass it, and that's true, very few do. But people who have any kind of technical background, a college degree in any kind of math or science or engineering, a lot of the times they'll score in the 50 to 60% range without ever looking at anything. So all I'm saying is the distance to get from where you walk in the door where you can pass the exam is a lot shorter than most people think it is. It's not as hard as your average person thinks it is. And I fight this all the time, people thinking that they're up against something which is impossible. And I'm always trying to convince people this is not nearly as hard as you think it is. And then they come back to me in 2 weeks and say, hey, you're right, it was a lot easier than I thought. I got a perfect score.
Well, I think that's very true, because what happens is folks get it in their mind, you know, this is an amateur radio exam, and it's an FCC type test, and you know, right. I don't know, I don't think I'm going to be able to pass this at all. And you're right, oh. It's not as difficult from that perspective. I was just saying that a person who has no background at all, Ham Test Online is absolutely, I think, the best way to go, because it's the most. The easiest way I've seen, you can get a book and you can read the book. You can get CDs and all that kind of stuff and listen to them. I don't know if anyone has a DVD training course out. Maybe they do. I don't know. I haven't come across it. But all that stuff is good, and I would recommend any of that stuff in conjunction with Ham Test Online. But I think that if you're just walking in off the street, I would definitely say this is the way to go. Now, tell me, how did you get involved in Ham Test Online? How? I know your partner, Pi. We run across each other at Dayton and at Huntsville all the time, and we're doing our live broadcast. He always comes over and sits down. And I know Pi is involved in the museum ships weekend real heavily because he and I have talked about that. But tell us about your background and tell us how did you get involved in it at the the beginnings of it and how it came about.
Okay, fair enough question. I was a ham back in the 70s and got my extra class license then. And then I had dropped out of ham radio to do the career and child raising thing. And that's a story you hear a lot. I mean, I man the phone support line for Ham Test Online. I talk to people all day long, and I hear this story over and over about people who were ham or wanted to be ham and never did get to be ham. Then, life got busy with life, and now they have a little more time. They want to get back into it. So I'm falling into that same category. At the same time, so in 2002, I was out jogging in the park, and I saw a sign that said, amateur radio operators are operating up in this field. Come join us. And I went, what the heck is that? Why would they be out in a field operating? I couldn't remember anything about it. It had been, decades. And you know how my memory is. But anyway, so I decided, I was going to be jogging some direction or other. I might as well jog up the hill and see what's going on up there. And Ty was up there, along with a bunch of other people from the local club, and they were doing field day. And I went, I remember field day. Field day is a lot of fun. Well, they had a GOTA station. For those who don't know what GOTA is, G-O-T-A, it means get on the air. Basically, someone who does not have a license or someone who does have a license but is not active can get on the air and actually operate under the supervision of another amateur radio of an amateur radio operator. And it's perfectly legal, and that's what I did. I went up there, and I operated. I did, 85 contacts on single sideband. I'd forgotten the Morse code. I couldn't do code that weekend. But I went in, and I operated, and I had a blast. And then I decided time to get my license. So then here you are in a situation where I wanted to get a license so that I could operate field day every year at a minimum and, get back into the hobby that I'd enjoyed so much when I was a teenager. But how are you going to do that? So I did what was commonly done. This was summer of 2002, and I think the most common way of a very common way for anyone, who knew anything about computers was to go to one of those websites that does the random free exams. So I went to one of the websites and started taking random exams and, memorizing the answers. And I will tell you this, if your goal is to pass the exam and your secondary goal is to spend as absolutely little money as possible doing it, then taking these free random exams on sites like QRZ and EHAM, that's a really effective way of doing it. They're very effective at helping you memorize the answers, and you will pass the exam. The problem, of course, with them is you don't learn anything. And I was frustrated by the fact that it's telling me the answers, but I'm trying, I want to understand the questions, and I want to understand the answers, and there's no information on there at all, and it was very frustrating. The other thing that frustrated me about it was the fact that they weren't keeping track of my answers, so they kept asking the same things over and over and over again that I already knew, and I knew there was stuff out there I hadn't seen, but it wasn't asking those because it's just throwing things at random without paying attention to what I've already seen. So I found that very frustrating. Well, it turns out I actually had some software that I had written years before for other purposes for drilling things of this nature. And so I loaded the question pools into that software and used it. And the advantage of this software is it keeps track of what you got right and what you got wrong. And as you're getting it right more often, you're going to see it less often. And every time you get it wrong, you're going to see it more often. So I finished up my studies for the extra using this software of mine just to drill the questions. Now that in and of itself did not solve the problem. I didn't have the information that I wanted. It wasn't teaching me anything at that point, which was still a frustration. But at least I wasn't getting the same questions over and over again. At least it was paying attention to what I was answering and acting with some kind of intelligence. I mean, we actually now call the algorithm intelligent repetition. So that was really, and then I went, and when I took the test, I got a perfect score. Well, they still had some Morse code testing then. I got 100% perfect copy on Morse code because I'd brushed up on that some. Got 100% score on the tech, 100% on the general, and I missed one on the extra. And Pi was part of the team who was administering, and I went to the team and I said, can I take the X over again? Because I missed one, and they laughed at me. So that's sort of the way it came about. But that was really just the kernel of the idea of what HAMTEST Online is, because it really only solved the problem of intelligent repetition. It didn't solve the problem of how do you actually teach somebody who's coming in off the street and doesn't know anything. And I think the answer, or they might know something, but you don't know how much they know, so you have to start at the beginning and catch up to where they know. I think that the secret to it is you put the materials in a logical learning order, and you break it down into very, very small bites. And then for each little piece of information, I wrote a very short, brief text, which gave them the information they needed to know in order to understand the questions and to understand the answers. I don't want to mislead anyone in any way. This will not make you an electrical engineer. I'm not going to teach you everything there is to know about electricity from fundamentals all the way up. I'm only teaching stuff that's asked on this exam. Fortunately, this exam is fairly comprehensive. It's not like there's going to be huge holes and huge gaps, but I'm not going to go into any kind of detail at all on the subjects that are not covered on the exam. So for me, for the first guy coming in, starting on his technician license, I start from what I consider to be the fundamental beginning, which is the definition of current and the definition of voltage. So my very first informational text that you'll see when you come on the website and you say, I want to start from the beginning, it'll say, current is the flow of electrons in a wire, and it's measured in amperes. Voltage is the electrical pressure that forces those electrons to move, and it's measured in volts. And that's basically all that I teach in your first bite-sized chunk. I do give a little analogy. I say, if you think of the flow of electricity as being similar to the flow of water in a pipe, then voltage is like the water pressure that forces the water to flow. And then, here's the magic of it. I keep the brain awake by asking a lot of questions. I've told you four things. I've told you what's current, what's amperes, what's voltage, and what's volts. And I told you that in three sentences if you include my little analogy there. Then I ask questions that are off the actual exam, word for word, character for character, identical to the ones you might see on the exam if you get the exam that has that particular one on it. This question pool has got like 400 questions, but you only see 35 on the exam. I ask you, what's the name used for the flow of electrons in an electric circuit, and you have to choose. Is it current, is it capacitance, resistance, or voltage? And you have to pick which one it is. Okay, Ted, here's your first test. What's the answer? You weren't listening, were you?
I was listening, but I did have I had a sudden distraction in the studio. We've just rebuilt the studio in here. So I did have a sudden distraction. So ask the question again, sir.
And that's the great thing about the software. It's infinitely patient. if you get it wrong the first time, it'll ask again and then again and again. And if it has to, it'll ask you. My customers tell me that the software is ruthless about making sure that you learn the simple stuff before it'll let you move on to the complex stuff. What is the name for the flow of electrons in an electric circuit? Is it current, voltage, resistance, or impedance?
Okay, so it would obviously be current. But if you were to say impedance, you know, you're just taking a wild guess at it, so you say impedance, then the test does what?
Actually, in this case, it'll come back and it'll say incorrect. Impedance is an opposition to the flow of current.
Okay.
And then it'll give you an opportunity, and then it asks you again, what is the word for and then you've got three choices left to choose from. Now you still have current, voltage, and resistance.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is if you miss that particular one, you say you're just guessing at it, and that's nothing wrong with a guess. If you guess at it, that question is going to come up again.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, first off, yeah, it does. In the explanation, it does tell you a little bit about why the answer you gave was wrong. Instead of just saying, you're wrong, try again, as a general rule, when it makes sense to do so, we give you some additional information to try and steer you in the right direction as to why that wasn't the right choice. But no, you always it's going to give you a chance to answer it again, and then I mean you will get it right eventually. There's only four choices, so eventually you're going to get the right one, and it'll move on to other stuff and go on and teach you stuff. But internally, it remembers the fact that you have had trouble with this question.
Well,
and then it's going to come back in 3 to 5 minutes, and it's going to ask you the question again, and it's going to see if you've learned it.
Okay, now see, now what I experienced, and I haven't had a chance to follow completely through on the study on Ham Test Online, but I've been up there, and I've had enough experience with it to where I found out that if I don't know the answer to the question, it repeats the question. And then, you know, it's like you're saying to yourself, wait a minute, I remember what the correct answer was. What was the correct answer? And you may not be able to grasp it this time. Okay, so you put something down, and it comes up, and it says it's wrong, and then it tells you what the answer, the correct answer is, and why. And you say, ah, man, why didn't I remember that? I mean, I should have remembered that. You know, and you go on to the next. You keep taking more, answering more questions, and bam, here comes that question again. And you know, if it seems to me that the next time it comes up, it might be worded slightly different than it was the first time you encountered it. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but it just seems like it might be worded slightly different, so it doesn't quite hit you the same way. Well, you know, you're all of a sudden, your brain says, wait a minute. I've been through this twice now, and uh-huh. I think I remember what the answer is.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and so you say, okay, let me see. So you check current, and then bingo, it's right. Okay, so now all of a sudden you realize that you're remembering the correct answer to that question. You know, and there's a little process that takes place there. You can feel the indentation in your brain, so to speak. And it's a painless way to learn things where, you know, in the past where you try to learn something, it can be really frustrating. Yeah, very frustrating. You know? And this is not, you know, because you know when you answer that question, you know when you're taking that guess, you say, I don't know if I... doesn't matter because it's going to come up again. And it'll keep coming up until you eventually learn it. And I think that puts everybody at ease. Once they realize that's happening, that's a process that's happening, they're not...
You're right in a sense, Ted. Basically, I think in this sense, it's not the responsibility of the student to keep track of his or her weak areas because the program will do it for you.
Well, I think...
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think that there's a... But there's this. See, I think there's a pressure that people, when their people are studying, say for a test like an amateur radio exam, there's a certain amount of pressure that they feel. I gotta learn this. Now, darn it, I gotta remember what this answer is. You know, and they think that way. But you see, I think what happens with Ham Test Online is you're going down the line studying. You realize, I don't have to strain. I don't have to sit here and grit my teeth and shut my eyes real tight and make fists and say, okay. You know, that, you know, this is what this is, you know. You don't have to do any of that, you know, because what's going to happen is it's just going to keep coming back until finally...
Very patiently.
...the brain absorbs it. And it's
a very, very, very
painless process. It is amateur radio brainwashing.
Amateur radio brainwashing.
Yeah.
You know, you can't make the pressure go away altogether. There's no way to do that because, you know, it's just you and the computer, and the computer truly is not a very judgmental thing. But still, there's you sitting there in judgment of yourself going, you know, darn it, I've seen this question 6 times, and I get it wrong every time. What's wrong with me? I can't take that pressure away. I can't make that go away. But you're right in the sense that you don't have to take responsibility for your own learning. All you have to do is the only responsibility you have to do is the responsibility to park your keister in the chair, log into the website, keep reading and answering questions. And as long as you're actually actively sitting there reading and answering questions, the software will take care of making sure that you learn everything you need to know. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that is really one of the most frustrating things, and that is to try to figure out what it is you don't know. You know, I'm weak in this area, I'm weak in that area. And you know what else? The areas you're weak in, you will tend to shy away from.
Yeah, not with this software. We're sort of the opposite of that. We're keeping track, not just really on a question-by-question basis, but also on a topic-by-topic and subject area-by-subject area basis. And the distinction between those two is subtle, but... we're keeping track, and it's not, we're not keeping track in a binary sense. I'm not keeping track of, okay, last time he answered this question, he got it right, or last time he answered, he got it wrong. I'm keeping track sort of like on a sliding scale. And I'm looking really not just at how you answered one question, but I'm looking at how you answered all sorts of questions that are related to that one question. You mentioned earlier you thought maybe sometimes it would come back with a different wording. Well, there are quite a few places in the exams where the same concept is asked in two or three different questions with different, a little bit different point of view. And in my software, I have those all linked together. I have them bound together. So if you're having trouble understanding a single concept from one point of view, you're going to see it frequently from all points of view until you've mastered the concept, and then when you start getting them right from every point of view, then it'll go away and you'll stop seeing it for a while.
Well, you know,
but it's all stored on a very sliding scale, so if you get it wrong three times in a row, there's internally, I'll tell you the internals of it, internally I'm keeping a score on every single question from 0 to 100, and my score is my program's estimation of the probability you would get it right if you saw it right now on an actual exam. And I might start off with a score of, say, 40. I might say, you know, the average person, because this question's a little bit simple and it relates to other things they've already seen, has a 40% chance of getting it right. If you get it right, I might up the score and say, okay, well, now the score on this one is 70, and so because I believe there's like a 70% chance you'd get it right because you saw it right once and you got it right once, but then, you know, that's no guarantee you're going to get right every time. Could have been a lucky guess. Then you turn around and you get it wrong, and I'm going to say, wow, he got this wrong. I'm going to knock it down to 35 or something. So for every single question, there's a score. I'm keeping track of a score for that for you as a user on it, and the score is based on a whole lot of things. One of the things is I have a database of over 50 million responses. I mean, I've sold tens of thousands of these courses, and I'm keeping track of every response in a big database. I got over 50 million responses, so I can tell you which ones people find difficult. And that gives me a good starting point for the scores on all of these. So that's a big factor that goes into, I know which questions are hardest. I'm looking at your answers to that question and to related questions and other questions in the topic. I'm looking, in fact, at how long it takes you to answer the question. That's not something I particularly tend to advertise because I don't want people to feel pressured to answer very quickly or something. But sometimes if someone hesitates and thinks for 3 minutes on it, that's a clue to me that maybe they don't have it very solid. And so that'll have a little subtle impact on your score. So I'll consider maybe you're a little bit weaker in this area than otherwise I would suspect. So I'm using
what about ADD people or a guy sitting or taking the exam, you know, and the phone rings. And So he picks up the phone and starts talking, or all of a sudden, you know, he discovers something shiny across the room, you know, so he's off in another, you know. What about ADD people? What does that do to their score, I wonder?
Yeah, and married people who keep getting interrupted every third question. Well, it doesn't do much. The effect of the delay is small. So, but it's in comparison to your delay on other things. I mean, it's not going to throw them off. But the great thing this program is really designed for people who have ADD. And you mentioned ADD as one thing. And the reason the software was developed in the first place is I have a severe case of ADD. Now, when I was growing up, they didn't call it that. They just said I was bad because I didn't pay attention in school. Well, that was the technical description of what the problem was with me. I couldn't pay attention in school. I just was unable to. And I still have a lot of trouble paying attention. But I survived in part and did fairly well in school, but in part because I learned to use flashcards. And flashcards, they work for me because they keep my brain awake. I think of it in terms of when someone is lecturing me on a subject, it's like they're trying to push information into my brain as if they were trying to push a string. And the trick, I think, to getting around ADD is to somehow or another motivate the brain to want the information. And I use a lot of tricks to motivate the brain to want information, but the biggest trick I use in the software is I teach by asking you questions. You know, I put you to sleep maybe. Evidently, earlier I put you to sleep when I told you the definition of current and voltage in my water pressure analogy. But then I immediately woke you up by asking you a question, and then you had to, you know, you had to wake up and then say,
you know,
answer.
That was a good illustration, except I had been distracted here is what happened. I had actually been distracted, and I hate that when we're doing a radio show, but that happens. It's life, you know. But you're right, because even in taking the study course, people are going to get distracted, you know. So, I mean, that's just the way it is, but... You're right.
Well,
that was a great...
That's another great thing about the software, is being doing it through software, that the computer is like the most patient tutor in the history of the universe. It's someone who will ask you a question, and if you get it wrong, it just remembers you got it wrong, and 5 minutes later it comes back and asks you. If you get distracted and you wander away and you forget to put the bookmark in your book and you come back and the book's closed, you may not even remember where you started, but you come back to the software... It remembers exactly what you know, and it knows how long it's been, and it knows when it's time for you to see a question again. If you've been away for a week, or in the instance of this one profile I happen to have up on my screen, there's a fellow here by the name of Ted Randall who hasn't been on the system since July 22nd of 2010. not to be critical or anything, it's not that I'm keeping track of my students. But the software is.
I think your statistics are wrong, but go ahead.
It knows how long it's been. So when you come back to study, you might find this a little bit frustrating because it's going to say, well, let's just go through pretty much everything from scratch and make sure he remembers it. And it really will. It'll go back and it will start with the simple questions and it will ask him to make sure that you still remember them.
It'll go through them
a lot faster the second time than it did the first time through.
Yeah, but I would not think that to be frustrating. I would think that would be welcome because, you know, I was telling you, the time restraints with my life right now are such that I have, you know, I don't get enough sleep at night, you know, let alone have time to do any studying. So when I get back online... I get back on Hamtest Online, I am going to want to go right back to the... I'll make sure I hadn't forgotten what I had learned or what I had studied. I think that's a very excellent part of the study exam. I think that's great.
Yeah, well, I think we have to do that. Otherwise, I mean, it's all part of the rigor of being ruthless to make sure that you understand the fundamentals before we go and try and build on those fundamentals. I mean, you can't just come in and take calculus 3 if you don't remember anything from calculus 1 and 2, which you know took long ago and haven't seen in a while. So I mean, we have to do it, but do some people find that frustrating? Yeah, some people have a lower frustration tolerance than others. Some people welcome it, some people get frustrated by it. Well, you know, but the good news is, I mean, I try to be as much as possible all things to all people. I mean, obviously you can't succeed entirely at that. But we do give the customer the ability to tailor how much repetition they get. There's over on the My Options screen, there's an option that controls the repetition. And you can change this factor and tell it. I mean, if you change the factor, you can turn off repetition altogether, although I don't recommend it, and I think very few people turn it off altogether, but you can tone it way down. You can say, you know, if you would normally repeat this thing after a week, wait and don't show it to me for 10 weeks. So by delaying how long it is before it repeats something, you wind up seeing a lot more new information.
Well, yeah, I personally think the repetition, though, is extremely important. I would think that's the key to it, because even though you may remember something, you know, today, and then you may remember it tomorrow, let 2 or 3 or 4 days go by, and without the repetition. But you know what? That's the entire basis of radio advertising, is repetition. And the advertising agencies that really know what they're doing are going to tell you, don't waste your time by running 1 or 2 commercials. It's not going to work. You need repetition.
It never sinks into the consciousness. It never gets into the consciousness of the person if they only hear it once. But, you know, it shouldn't be randomized either. It needs to be intelligently selected repetition, especially for learning something like this. For instance, there's a question that says, what's the name of the government agency that regulates the radio services? And the answer is FCC, and everybody gets it right the first time, and no one ever misses this question. This is not one that you need to repeat over and over and over again. Well, the software is programmed. It knows that this is the easiest question in all of the question pools, and it will show you once. You'll get it right, and assuming you get it right that one time, you'll never see that one again. But then the question that you got wrong, if you got the question about current wrong, you're going to wind up seeing that question maybe five times. And that's the difference between just repeating things at random and repeating things with some intelligence for some particular reason. You need to see this one more often. But we do it so down to, you know, we get to the point where, you know, like some people might be really good at electronics and really bad at regulations. And because, you know, who knows, maybe they have a technical background or something. And so, like you were saying, you have a tendency to focus on the areas where you're strongest, but this is going to find your areas that you're weakest, and that's where it's going to put the focus. It's almost as if, I mean, it is, that the software is keeping track on a question-per-question basis, and it remembers forever. And you can't fool it. There's no way to fool it other than just answering them right every time. And if you can do that, then you're not fooling it, are you?
I just want to say this for those who have just tuned in. You're listening to QSO. And, of course, it's all about ham radio. Our guest today is John Cunningham, W1AI. He is with Ham Test Online. And that's what we're talking about. And why are we talking about Ham Test Online? Because this is a very, very effective way of getting your amateur radio license. If you're a shortwave listener and you're tuned in and you've always said, well, you know, one of these days I'm going to get my license. Well, you know what? This is the way to do it. It really is. Not only is it, and this is not an infomercial. I just feel very strongly that it should be as painless and as easy as it can. Now, you know, something I've noticed, and I've noticed this ever since I was just a youngster, because I got into ham radio relatively early in life. It seems as though there are those in our hobby that make things 10 times more difficult than it really is. And they make things look 10 times more difficult than what it really is. And I think they scare a lot of people away. So, your point earlier when you were saying that the technician test was a throwaway exam, and I was saying, oh, no, it's not, the man on the street. But to a large extent, all of it is easier than what has been portrayed, I think, for the most part. Now, what I mean by that is this. Yes, you have to study to get the license. But It's nowhere as impossible as some folks might make it seem. I think with some hams, I really do, I believe this, some radio operators, amateur radio operators, when they get a license, somehow it affects them. I don't know how, but it does. You know, they automatically become an authority. They carry flares and an orange jumper in the trunk of their car, okay? Yep. They love large flashlights with big D batteries in them, okay? They own two or three generators at the house. They have food stored in the basement, you know? Now, I'm going way to the extreme, but I mean, that does happen. You do have some of that flavor mixed in with the hobby. And I think the average normal person, it kind of scares them off. They think that this is an extreme hobby. Well, it's not. You know, people look at shortwave and say, well, you know, gee whiz, those radios are very complicated. No, they're not. They have a volume and a tuning knob on them, just like an AM or an FM radio. It just so happens that the signals coming in from all these distant places are far more interesting to listen to than the stuff that's being broadcast in your own city. And I guess what I'm saying is what I like about Ham Test Online and why I think it's so cool, and it's cool to get on and talk about this, is because it isn't impossible. It is relatively easy. And this thing, this Ham Test Online, has got to be the most ideal situation for a person to be able to just log on to an online site, and in 20 minutes a day, 30 minutes a day, as long as you stay at it, and you don't look do like I do, as long as you stay at it, you're going to get the license. You're going to learn the material. And it's not going to hurt. There's no pain involved, you know, and you don't even have to really think about what it is that you do know or you don't know. All you have to do is just show up every day and answer the questions and give it some concentration and some effort. But I don't know. I'm just going to ask you, John, have you not run into this situation I'm talking about where, you know, somebody makes something that's relatively simple way more complex than it needs to be?
Well, you know, I have to confess, when you said that, the first thing that popped into my mind was the ARRL license manual.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, as a general rule, I try not to diss any of my competitors, but I'll tell you that I get a lot of people tell me that they try to read the ARRL license manuals, and they find them to be very difficult to follow, and they get bogged down. I remember in particular the last Hamvention I was at. We missed Hamvention this year, but the prior year, talking to a kid who was 16 years old, and he said he started studying for this extra with the ARRL license manual for the extra class. And he said the first chapter was really good, but by the time he got partway into the second chapter, he felt like he'd wandered into a lecture on quantum mechanics, and he had absolutely no idea what they were talking about. And, you know, I sympathize in a sense with the people who wrote the manual because it's complicated stuff, but you ought to be able to find some way of explaining it in a way that's going to make sense to people. And I think that, I try really hard to find simple ways of explaining things. I'm a plain spoken type of person. I'm not very pretentious. I don't typically use long, fancy words when I can use shorter ones. And I try and keep it simple, and I keep it straight to the point. I think the problem that goes on with the people who write these books is, here they are working for the prestigious National Association of Amateur Radio, and they feel like they're surrounded by people who, you know, would scoff at people who only have one PhD in electronics, and somehow or other it seems like they try to make, well, you said it, they make things more complicated than they need to be.
Lord, yes.
I work really hard to try and make it as simple as possible. I mean, here's the bottom line. Sometimes electrical engineers, they like to show the characteristics of a circuit on a two-dimensional chart, and on one axis they put resistance, on the other axis they put impedance. And the term that they use for this is, an impedance graph. And that's what you have to know something about in order to answer this next bunch of questions. And I'm going to tell you a few things about impedance graphs that so you'll understand what the questions are, because resistance is always positive, then the points are always going to be to the right side of the vertical axis, and I just go through and I put it as plainly and simply as I possibly can. But at the same time, I'm also leaving a lot of stuff out. I'll give you, we talked a few minutes ago about the whole current and voltage thing. And I was kind of frustrated when I was trying to read the ARRL license manual. Well, I shouldn't say frustrated. I read it to see what they had to say about current and voltage. Because I read, when I write an article, I go out and I read like 10 different sources. And I see what everybody has to say on it. And I make sure I understand the subject very thoroughly. And then I close all the books and write it in my own words. But they spent two-thirds of a page explaining to you about the charge on an electron, what is a coulomb, what is Avogadro's number. And they went on and on and on about a whole slew of things like this, two-thirds of a page, and none of it's on the exam. And you don't need to know the definition of a coulomb in order to understand electricity. I mean, if you want to, if you're planning to get a degree in electrical engineering, then absolutely you do need to know what a coulomb is, and you better know Avogadro's number off the top of your head. But it's not on the exam, and you don't need it to be a ham radio operator. So I don't teach it. I start with, it's the flow of electrons in a circuit. And, I think pretty much everybody above the age of, 10 knows what an electron is and what a circuit is. So I don't teach those two things. But I start based on something that pretty much everybody already knows, and that's all I'll do. But why make it so much more complicated than it needs to be? And the problem with it is, I like the fact that the license and manuals have a great deal of information, but except for the fact that that's what turns so many people off to the hobby. They never, ever manage to get into it because they feel like it's so complicated because the books make it seem so much more complicated than it really is. There, how is that for not dissing my competitors? I guess I blew that one, huh?
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. What you're saying, though, is real. And that is, I recall, even as a youngster, looking at the ARRL study guides and even going to the classes where you have a local ham teaching. And I will not diss people who volunteer. I mean, I've been around hams. I've been around hams who have held these classes, and out of the purest intentions, all they're wanting to do is see young people get a license. Okay, now that I've seen. On the other hand, I've seen hams that get up to teach the classes that want to tell everybody how much they know. And they make it so complicated, you can watch the students just kind of drop off. And by the time you get to the end of the course, you know, there's nobody left. They've just run everyone off, you know. Now, there's two extremes like that, and then there's, of course, obviously stuff in the middle. But, I mean, a lot of effort goes into writing those license manuals, and I love the ARRL, and I'm a member, and our whole family's a member, and I tell everybody that I think everyone should be a member of the league. But I will have to agree, and that is they really can't be everything to everyone, and I think the license manuals, if you don't have anything else, you know, you can study those and get a license, but it is a lot more difficult to go down that road. And I think a lot of the folks that write, here's another thing, too. You know, I've been told this, and I tend to believe this, that most hams, and if you go to an amateur radio ham fest, you go to Dayton, you go to maybe not as much Dayton and Huntsville because the numbers are so large. But you'll immediately see that our group of people, and I say our group of people, are somewhat socially challenged, okay?
Some of them, yes.
And the reason why is because the hobby attracts a more technical sort of minded person. In other words, we tend to be geeks. We tend to be nerds. We tend to be those people who are fascinated with gadgets, you know. And we're very preoccupied. Many of us are ADD. You know, and my definition of ADD is there's just too doggone many interesting things in the world to pay attention to just one thing at a time. So that's how I see it, you know. But I think what happens is in these manuals, you have people who are very, very technically versed, and they don't understand. They just don't understand the principle of how to keep it really simple, because their understanding is much broader, much wider. So now we come back over to Ham Test Online, and that's exactly what you've achieved. You've kept technical information. You've kept it at what I would consider to be a normal level. In other words, you are not presenting it as something far more complex than what it is. Matter of fact, if anything, you're making it appear as simple as possible, and that makes it comprehensible to the person. But I appreciate your comments, and I think it's a good thing to talk about, because I think it's something that the league needs to think about in terms of as they upgrade their study materials and things like that. They need to keep that in mind, that, you know, we're trying to get the general public into this hobby. We're not trying to attract college professors and people who have PhDs in electronics. We're trying to get the guy off the street, you know, to be interested in putting the Citizens Band radio away, or not putting his shortwave radio away, but getting an amateur rig and getting on the air and becoming part of the hobby. And part of that is, if you want to call it, an evangelistic outreach. You've got to make it within the grasp of the person that wants to get the license. If you immediately present them with a complex picture, it's going to scare them. And a lot of them just going to put the book down and say, boy, I'll never learn this. You know, and I think that happens an awful lot. I really do.
Absolutely. I mean, I hear that absolutely every day. You know, I had the manual, and I started it, and I got partway through, and I got discouraged, and I quit. I hear that all the time.
But you don't hear that. You don't hear that. You don't hear that with your study material, though.
Well, you know, I would like to say that I don't, but I do in a sense. I do get a lot of people who will log in and study. Say, for instance, let me just check this screen here real quick. For say 2 hours and 51 minutes, and then they go away. And they don't log in for almost a year. I get a lot of that. And I think it's what you were saying. There's so many interesting things going on in the world. It's hard to stay focused on any one thing for a long time. And we haven't been able to, we've been working on this thing, you know, but it takes hardware to try and, you know, where if you don't study for more than a week, it'll, next time you touch the keyboard, it'll give you a shock. And we've been working on this, but, you know, there's a hardware thing, the problem we haven't been able to resolve here about the, you know, shocking people to get them to come back and study. I would say that, you know, of the tens of thousands of subscriptions we sold, maybe half of them, the people have gone away and not come back for long periods of time. Sometimes they do. A lot of times they, you know, a lot of times they'll come back to us after a year and they'll say, I love your product. It's really great. I was learning a lot, but, you know, I got distracted and was doing other things. Now I want to renew so that I can continue my studies. We had people who subscribed in 2004 at Hamvention, and they renewed in 2006, renewed in 2008, renewed in 2010, and boy, I chastise them, let me tell you. I'm one for telling people, look, I do not want to see you in 2 years coming back to renew. I want to get an email from you in 3 months telling me you got your extra, and I don't want to hear from you after that.
But those same people, when they're successful, they're going to recommend you. They're going to recommend Ham Test Online to other friends. Yeah, and that's what's happened. Well, that's my initial exposure to Ham Test Online was through a friend of mine, and his wife took the got her technician license through Ham Test Online, and they were just thrilled because I don't think they thought she was going to be able to get a license, you know. And she got on there, and boy, I mean, it was in a matter of a couple of weeks, 3 weeks or so, she had her ticket. So,
Ted, it's not as hard as you think it is. It doesn't take 3 weeks to get a technician license. I get people, you know, I got 5-year-olds who do it in less than a week.
We're not supposed to talk about that, okay? All right? You know, can you knock it off? I mean, you know, there's no point in making, you know. Anyhow, tell me a little bit. We'll get back to Ham Test Online here in a minute, but I want you to tell me a little bit about your background in ham radio. How'd you get into ham radio originally? And I know you said you got in it, you got out of it, and then you got back in it again. But how did you get in the first time? What attracted you in, and what was that all about?
Ham radio is a social hobby. I had a friend who was interested in it, and it seems like kind of interesting. I was obviously the nerd and the geek in high school, and there was a local amateur radio club. I was living in Raleigh, North Carolina, and they were, it was part of the RARS outreach. They had a novice class, and I went to a class, and it was well taught, and I learned a lot, and they gave an exam, and I learned the Morse code. And I loved it, and it was, for me, it was always social. I was surrounded with friends who were into ham radio, and then, you know, we grew up a little bit and graduated from high school and went off to college. I had a friend who moved to, started studying Cornell University, and we had a sked. We'd get together I don't remember how often it was, and of course, as novices, it was all Morse code, but it was always very social. For me, the best part of ham radio, and this is, you know, even after I got my extra, the best part of ham radio was operating Morse code, 40 words a minute, all night long for field day. And just the flavor of eggs cooked in bacon grease first thing in the morning after you've been working all night long, it's really nothing to compare. It was interesting. Ham radio got me into electronical engineering. I was a double E major for a year. You know, a lot of people assume just because I can write courses on these complex electronic topics that I must have a PhD in electrical engineering or something. I don't. I switched over and studied computers after, you know, just a year of studying Double E. But ham radio got me into that. So, so ham radio, in some sense, encouraged me to become more technical. But, you know, then I found the love of my life, and there was nothing that could stop me from pursuing that, that, of course, being computers.
Well, let me ask this question, because this is something that has been, well, let's just go down this road. Mm-hmm. Are you ready?
Sounds dangerous. That sounds dangerous.
Are you ready?
Bring it on.
Bring it on. Well, you know, I have heard this so much, and this acquaintance of mine, the other day I was, it's been some time ago, it's not the other day, but might as well have been. We were talking, and the subject of Echolink came up.
Yeah.
And the person said to me, "Oh, Echolink, I call it Echo Stink." And I said, "What?" You know, and he's like, "You know, well, it's not really ham radio." And does that just get under my skin? I can't help it. You know, I think Echolink is probably one of the most fantastic things that's happened to amateur radio. Now, it may not interest everyone. CW doesn't interest everyone. Packet doesn't interest everyone. AM doesn't interest everyone. You know, that's one thing that's beautiful about the hobby. But the marriage right now of computers and amateur radio, to me, seems to be like an incredible milestone. It's like no telling what could come out of this, you know, where it could go and where it could wind up. So I guess my question is your primary interest, as you said, is in computers. How do you see the computer in ham radio today?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. You know, I haven't really given this any thought. I'm not sure I have anything intelligent to say on the subject. I mean,
Think about it. You know, you've got a radio made by a company that has a Cat5 connector on the back of it, okay? Bob Heil and I were talking one day, and he's in his hotel room somewhere, you know, and he's logged in through his notebook into the ham radio at home. And conversing with friends on the frequency that he usually hangs out on, which is, I think it's 3875 or something like that. You know, I mean, I'm saying, you know, this is so cool. I have Echolink on my Droid phone, you know, and I can log into repeaters all over the world and talk right over my phone. I mean, say, this is incredible, I think. You know, I mean, that's how I see it, but go ahead.
Yeah, I got it on my iPhone. I got Echolink on my iPhone. I don't use it a lot. I'm not, you know... The thing is, with the internet and, you know, Skype and chat and all of this stuff, to some extent, that has made amateur radio obsolete. You mean, kids, I don't think we're getting that many kids into the hobby the way we were, say, 40 years ago. Because kids will say, well, what's the point of this? I can just go on Skype and I talk to anyone in any country for free anytime I want. And I could do video conferencing and don't have to deal with, you know, any atmospheric interference. I personally don't find that part of ham radio, the Echolink, the 2-meter repeaters, I don't find that to be the most fascinating part. I like the challenge. I still am very much drawn to the challenge. Trying to talk to someone in Yugoslavia with no wires whatsoever, just purely by having an antenna that's up high enough and putting out a good enough signal and knowing which way to point it so that and knowing what time of day to try it so that I can actually talk just by bouncing this radio wave up to the ionosphere, back to the Earth, off the ocean, back to the ionosphere, back to the Earth, and bam, there it is. I'm talking to somebody who's, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of miles away, and I could barely hear them because there's lightning crashes and there's signals fading in and out, but I'm good because I got a pretty good ear because I've been doing it for a while, and I find that to be the fun part. Just the challenge, and the challenge of being able to operate in our conditions, like where you're at a special event station. I do a lot of the, you know, Pi gets me involved in a lot of his projects, and he's, like you said, involved in a lot of things, including Museum Ships Weekend and I love going out on Museum Ships Weekend and being on board, you know, USS Salem or wherever we are at the time, and just best part is when you got 12 people calling you at once and you try and keep track of them all and work them all, make sure they all get properly logged. I mean, to me, that's the cool part of ham radio. I have Echo Link on my iPhone, and I think I may have used it like 3 times in the last year.
You know, I don't use it much at all. I mean, I very seldom get on, but I am so fascinated that my phone has Echo Link on it, and I can log into the repeater in Ann Arbor, Michigan, off my cell phone, and talk to friends of mine in the Detroit area where I grew up, and over those repeaters. There's one, I guess, the General Motors repeater has Echo Link on it. You know, I mean, they're all over the country and all over the world. You know, but I just, to me, I mean, I, you know, what a crazy thing. You know, here you are sitting in an area, say like a doctor's office or maybe in a parking lot waiting for someone, and you're bored, you know, and you can pull out your cell phone and log into a repeater somewhere. I mean, come on. I mean, this is incredible. How many other people can do this? Now, I know that it's just as easy to pick up the cell phone and call somebody direct in Germany.
Somebody. Yeah. On their cell phone. Yeah.
Yeah. But by the same token, you're...
Worldwide two-way radio network. It's called cell phones.
Yeah. But the thing is here you are sitting in your car in some city like where I'm at near Nashville, Tennessee, and I can log in and talk to some guy driving his car, talking over his amateur radio in on the Autobahn or on the I-94 freeway in Detroit or some other location somewhere in the country, somebody in their car, somebody on an HT, you know, out in the middle of a cornfield via amateur radio. And I guess the way I look at it is the link side of it. The Echo Link side, I guess I want to say, the computer side, the cyber side of it, you know, is to me just as much ham radio as the transceiver sitting on my desk that's hooked up to a double extended ZEP, you know, with open wire line. To me, it's all part of it. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, we get hung up. It's like years ago when everything was AM and single sideband came along. It was quite a controversy. You know, those guys absolutely hated sideband. Well, that said Donald Duck talk, you know. I don't want to say Donald Duck. You know, everything sounds like Donald Duck. You know, well, you know,
right.
You know, well, maybe it did. But look at look at now. Look at how good single sideband sounds, you know. And I remember that. And then there were wars. I mean, there were guys on there that absolutely hated sideband. And now, even today, there's people on sideband that hate those guys on AM, you know. So it's
because the guys on AM deserve it.
Well, maybe some do, but not all of them. I happen to love listening to the AM QSOs because they're so pleasing to the ear. I mean, you tune them in, and being an old AM broadcast engineer, I appreciate hearing these guys. I heard a guy the other day, a young fella on there talking. He had a homebrew AM transmitter that had PDM modulation on it. You know, I thought to myself, he just had built all this stuff from scratch. And I hear a lot of that with the AM crowd. I hear a lot of those guys building things, you know. And, of course, you know,
sometimes a few people can really make a whole group look bad. A few impolite people can really
but you know, that's,
spoil a whole section.
That is a problem. That is a real problem. In amateur radio, but even on sideband. Now, let me just give you an example. There's places on the 75-meter band at night that if you were to tune in and listen to it for any length of time, you know, it'd make a hooker blush.
I don't know why we can't get more enforcement.
Well, it's true. It really is. You know, but now we also have to look at another thing, too. We got to look at radio in general, and that is there's stuff going out over broadcast radio that years ago, if you were to do anything like that, even on broadcast radio, the FCC would have pulled your license. They'd have taken it away from you. See, so what's accepted today and what was accepted 20 years ago is like apples and oranges. that's really a shame, I think, because I think they've lowered the standard of the broadcast industry. I mean, I go back to thinking that, you know, here we are. I'm getting pretty political here, but I really don't care. I can if I want to. you got a guy like whose radio show was sold out all the time. He was in demand. And as long as the heart beat inside his chest, he was never going to be without being prominent in the broadcast industry. And that was Paul Harvey. And Paul Harvey never did anything off color. Paul Harvey never got into any sort of degradative type conversation or gossip. It was all above the board. It was all entertaining. It was all information. It was all clean, pure, all those kind of qualities.
Very pleasant to listen to.
You know, and young people, I've watched teenagers pull off the road when Paul Harvey would come on because they didn't want to miss the rest of the story. I mean, you know, and what drama. You know, he really was a master at this. And this is something we've lost. There's something else we've lost, too, I think. In terms of amateur radio, for the most part, we have lost the art of conversation. You don't hear people as much. Now, you'll hear these groups, like on 80 at night, you'll hear them. Maybe more. I really think 40 Meters is probably my favorite band, but on 80 at night, you hear these guys talking. They got a little like a round table going. For the most part, well, if you do a round table today, they don't like that. You know, everybody wants to just jump in and talk, and that's fine. Most of the round tables and most of the frequencies that I encounter on 80 meters at night, listening to it, they're pretty friendly. If you jump in, they'll pull you right into the conversation. Now, there's not a problem. But there are some frequencies where these guys are very snobbish, and they really think there's something special. And you'll hear now, and not myself much because I don't have much time. I listen far more than I ever transmit or talk. But I'll hear somebody jump in and just say something. Hey, I just got a radio, or I just put up an antenna, you know. And you'll hear some comment like, hit the road, Toad. You know, get you an amplifier. Can't hear you. Don't talk to mobiles. You know, that kind of thing, you know. And I think that in itself is a real detriment to the hobby. I listened one night to a bunch of guys on there. A couple of guys got in and they got hit over the head being called no code generals, you know, and intimidated that way. I just don't think we have any room for that. I think it needs to be, once again, we need to get back to the fact that ham radio is supposed to be a fraternity.
These are people who are operating phone and looking down on someone for not having passed the Morse code exam.
No, exactly. Yeah, you know,
I think the rule should be if you're gonna insult somebody for not having passed the Morse code exam, you should at least be able to do that insult in Morse code.
Well, yeah, and the thing is that it's irrelevant. When I was in at Huntsville 2 years ago, we were right beside Vibraplex, and got to talking to the fellow that owned the company back then. And he said, you know, since they've dropped the code requirement, he said, we're actually selling more than we ever did when the requirement was there. Well, I also talked to Gordon West, and Gordon said, yep. He said, my code classes, he said, all the stuff that I put out on code, he said, the sales have gone way up since the requirement was lifted.
Well, the number of people coming into ham radio has gone way up.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, now the thing of it, I guess what I'm saying is, you would expect that if code were hated so much, that all of that would have just dropped to zero. You know, people would have went over and got their Vibraplex and throw it in the trash can. You know, I don't need this anymore. You know, but the thing of it is that, you know, with ham radio, everything in it, there are so many different facets that interest so many different people. That's one of the things that makes it really cool. But I think I really believe we have lost, like, for you're talking about working DX, but I don't know. You don't, maybe I'm wrong, but you don't strike me as being a hyper DX contester, unless I'm wrong.
No, I'm not. Okay. I do, you know, occasional special event stations. I like to be in the pointy end of the pileup if possible.
Special event stations are so cool, and that's another thing. But I guess, you know, operating on HF, I guess I have to be considered more of a casual operator. You know, I mean, I enjoy talking to DX, but I enjoy talking. You know, I don't like this quick check-in stuff. You know, you're 599, boom, yeah. On to the next guy. You know, I want to ask the guy, you know, tell me a little bit about your family and what do you do for a living and tell me what it's like living where you're at, and I'll tell you a little bit about where I'm at. And to me, that's that cultural exchange is really what makes it magic. I mean, it really
does.
That
was really one of the things that I wanted out of ham radio at the very, very beginning was those kinds of exchanges. I wanted to be able to reach out and touch people. I wanted to learn something about who they were. And one of the reasons that I gave it up when I started getting really busy with other stuff was I found that I wasn't spending any time getting the kinds of communications I was looking for with people. That I would reach out and I'd make a contact with someone, and all they'd want to really do is describe how tall their antenna was and what kind of radio they were, and then they wanted to go on to the next. And I found that that was a little bit frustrating. Just to casually go on and make six contacts, you know, before dinner, I've never really gotten into that. I mean, I'm a goal-oriented person, so, you know, I like the contests, you know, I like the special events where you're trying to achieve a goal. I like, you know, trying to go, I've heard things like Worked All States and, you know, DXCC, and I, you know, those are the kinds of things that would attract me. But what I really wanted to do was be able to reach out and touch somebody's soul. And I'm not convinced that ham radio has turned out to be an effective medium for me to do that.
Well, you know, I think it can be. You know, I've discovered that in my approach to it, that's definitely something that happens almost every time I turn on the radio. But let me tell you the difference. Okay, I don't break into a conversation. I go off on a frequency somewhere and just start calling CQ. Now, you don't see that too often. You don't hear it on 80 meters. It's almost non-existent, you know, but there I'll be calling CQ on 80. And inevitably somebody will come back to me and will act as if like, were you calling CQ on 80 here? You know, yeah. How you doing tonight? Where you at? Tell me a little bit about your family. You know, that kind of thing. And the next thing you know, you're engaged in a conversation. You know,
sure.
And this is a conversation that would not have taken place if you hadn't called CQ. So I guess the thing I'm saying is that's I try to separate it from the normal mode that everybody falls into. I will break in on QSOs and talk for a few minutes to somebody or a group of people. If they're on an interesting subject and I may jump in and make a comment, that's fine. But for the most part, I like to just park myself on some part of the band somewhere and just call CQ and wait for someone to come back to me. Create a QSO. You know, I mean, and then when you create one, then you can kind of follow your own format. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to get into a group.
Right. I mean, there's no rule saying your QSO has to follow some sort of procedure. I mean, some sort of pattern or something that you have to exchange operator's name and radio and antenna. You can really make whatever you want out of it.
And
I was a lot shyer when I was like 20 years old.
Well, you know, I think what is interesting is this friend of mine. When I was just very, very young, there was a guy by the name of Nelson Cosby. I can't remember what Nelson's call sign is, but he's up in Dearborn, Michigan. And that was the first time I'd ever seen amateur radio actually demonstrated. And, he was a big 20 meter buff, had a 20 meter beam. And it's odd when you're a kid, you remember everything. You know, it's like, I remember he had an SX-101 Hallicrafters receiver. He had a Heathkit Marauder exciter. A homebrew 813 amplifier, you know, this is all in the basement, and a 20 meter beam. And the only contact I heard him make was a guy in Denver And he was just demonstrating amateur radio. But he said something to me as a kid that really impressed me. And he said, everybody I talked to, and on, he had his log there. He said, everybody I talked to, he said, I ask him about their occupation, what they do for a living. Right. Now, that's only one question. But when he asks that question, it opens up conversation wide. In other words, you know, when you ask somebody, well, I'm curious what you do for a living, and they tell you what it is, now you're engaged in a conversation because you're going to have questions and they're going to tell you answers to those questions and back and forth. But that really impressed me. I thought, that's interesting. I wonder, and that stuck in my head. So consequently, once I got the license, that was something I was just compelled to do, was to ask the person on the other end, what do you do for a living? What's your occupation? And I'm telling you something, you get some answers, it'll blow your mind. I mean, you'll discover occupations and things people making a living doing things you hadn't even thought of. And in different parts of the world, different occupations are possible that maybe are not possible here in the U.S., but you learn about all this stuff, and it just, you know, it really kind of blows your mind. And then when you do that, sometimes you'll discover you're talking to someone of an extreme caliber. You know, somebody that is, you may wind up talking to some real high-ranking government official from a foreign country. And you have no idea that that's who you're talking to unless you ask the question.
Right.
So you begin to, so what I think is cool is when you engage in a QSO, and then you are able to ask questions. You know, you call CQ, you get on the air, and then you got your own little thing, what you'd like to know about that person. But I think one of the things that we fall down on, first off, I think we fall down by not calling CQ. The second thing we fall down on is we don't ask questions. You know, we start telling folks about what we do and who we are, but we don't ask them questions. Kind of, we don't really discover the person that we're talking to. Now you tell me, am I making any sense or am I just rambling here?
No, you're making perfect sense. I mean, basically what you've done is you've sort of pushed people out of their pattern. And once you've got them off into this area that's unknown to them, then they might try and steer you back into the pattern by talking about their antenna. But, you know, if you can keep them out of that space, you know, it's a question that I'd, never really thought of. You know, if someone had said to me when I was 20 years old and feeling frustrated about the inconsequentiality of all of these conversations we were having, there was that long word that I shouldn't have used. I ought to come up with a better one if I'm writing an info text. If someone had said to me, all you have to do is say, start by asking them, what do you do for a living? I mean, I just didn't think to do that. That might have really made some sort of a difference to my whole perception of what was possible with ham radio was. Like I was going to say, I mean, I was a kind of a shy kid, and like you say, a little bit socially awkward. I had confessed earlier I was the geek and the nerd in the school, and I excelled at the technical things and was very behind socially. And I didn't have that conversational skill that that you have. But, you know, sometimes the real secret is just to have a few pointers as to how to get started, and maybe I'd have been in a lot better shape with it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you're maybe being way too critical of yourself, because you're going to ask the questions that you're the most interested in, you know, unless you're totally, completely intimidated by the person on the other end. And that happens sometimes. Sometimes you get into...
I was pretty shy.
Yeah, you get into a QSO, and... all of a sudden, you find out you're talking to whomever it is. You know, you get a little intimidated. You're thinking, "Oh my goodness, I got this person on the other end." And then,
here I'm a kid, and you're talking to somebody who's twice your age and has all this experience and all this money and all of this. Been ham radio operator for longer than I've been alive, and you know, it's a little intimidating for a kid. I mean, for a shy kid.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. When I was younger. And I guess today this applies. And I guess I'd encourage people to do this. I think this is all part of the hobby. Do you know what I used amateur radio for when I was younger?
What's that?
tech support.
Yeah, girl.
Tech support. Yeah, because if you had a problem, and I remember, you know, working on some old reel-to-reel tape recorders, you know, back then, of course, they weren't old, they were new.
Sure.
You know, and I was having problems aligning a tape head. I was having problems with a hum that I couldn't track down. I was having problems with tape alignment, or I was having problems with an amplifier, an audio amplifier, or a turntable or something. And you could get on amateur radio and say, here's what's going on. You know, and some guy would come right back to you and say, oh, well, let me tell you what to do.
Yeah.
You know, and he'd answer your question. You know, so there wasn't any problem I encountered in terms of electronics or audio or anything like that, that I, if I got on the air and I asked a question two or three times, I would get the answer I needed because it was like a tech support pool. And if you got into a discussion with a bunch of guys out of 8 or 9 people that were on the frequency at the same time, somebody either knew the answer or they knew another ham that did.
Yeah.
And that was most
very
amazing.
Brilliant people in our hobby.
And I think that probably holds true today. Now, I don't know. Do you find, you know, because your forte obviously is in the computer side of things. Do you find that most hams, or I guess what would I say, the percentage? What would the percentage be of hams in terms of being, you know, computer savvy? Somebody that you could, that would say would be someone you could get into a conversation with that would be meaningful. How many hams are computer savvy, do you think?
Well, it's probably higher than the general population, but I wouldn't say that the majority of them are. I deal with people who are sort of self-selected for being computer savvy. I mean, I'm talking to people all day long because they found me on the computer. A lot of the times, though, it'll be because a friend, you know, talked them into it, and, you know, and... But not, you know, I would not say that my average student was very computer savvy. You know, the thing about ham radio is you know how many people build their own radio? What, 1% maybe? And even those mostly from a kit. But you get some people who are super super brilliant, and they know a lot about electrical engineering and stuff. But the majority, not so much. And I think it's the same with computers. I mean, I certainly do talk to a lot of people who are computer savvy, but I would not, by any stretch of the imagination, say that the majority of my customers are... I mean, I find myself in the conversations when I'm trying to explain to someone how you would navigate to my website.
Yeah, I know.
I've been in conversations where I was trying to explain to people the concept of copy and paste. I'm not making this up. Boy, I tell you, some of the things I hear on the phone, you cannot make this stuff up.
Incidentally, but, for those that have just tuned in, I just want to let you know that our guest today, you're listening to QSO, a radio show that's about ham radio. And I'm Ted Randall, and we're talking to John Cunningham, who is with Ham Test Online. His call sign is W1AI. And while I have, while I am speaking here, I will invite you folks to go to our website, which is QSOradioshow.com, QSOradioshow.com, or just simply TedRandall.com, TedRandall, and go up there, and there's a link there to Ham Test Online. So if you can't remember HamTestOnline.com, then you can go to our website and hit the link. Also, while you're up there, shoot us an email and tell us where you're listening from. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're listening on, and put in that email, I want to win, because we give things away every month, and we'd like to reach into the prize closet and pull something out and send it to you. So be sure to put on there, I want to win. Once again, just go to TedRandall.com, TedRandall, TedRandall.com, and QSOradioshow.com. We'd love to hear from you. We exist to hear from you folks when you write us and tell us what you think and all that kind of thing. And we'd love to know where you're at, because this radio show travels on shortwave radio the most interesting radio bands and the form of radio listening there is, and that is international shortwave radio. Now that I've ran my mouth about that, one of the reasons why I wanted John on, and he's with Hamtest Online, and we've been way off the beaten path talking about all kinds of interesting things. But Hamtest Online was something that I ran across through a friend of mine, and had a chance to meet John and Pi at, I think Huntsville was the first place that I met Pi, and then Dayton, obviously. And this is a website, but it's a programmed method of learning that is just super user friendly. And we talked about things here. We talked about the fact that when you go up to a Hamtest Online and you sign up and you get on Hamtest Online, the testing and the teaching procedure is intelligent, so it continues to review things that you don't know. We had discussed the fact that if you don't know a particular thing, then the question will continue to reappear until you finally understand it and memorize the answer, but also it will give you an explanation adequate enough to where you understand what it is that they're asking. Now, this is something else, John. I was going to bring this up, and I didn't do it, but I'm going to do it now. When you're trying to study for a test, and you know you come across the answer and you say, you know, I know what the correct answer is, but man, I haven't got the slightest idea what they're talking about. You know, it's like, you know, how many widgets, you know, are in the widget basket? You know the correct answer is 3, but you have no idea why there's widgets in the basket to start with, okay? Now, the thing is that with Hamtest Online, you give the folks an explanation, but not one that goes in so much detail and depth that it confuses them. In other words, this is pretty concise. And there's enough of an explanation there to where they actually start to learn the material. They actually begin to understand what it is that you're asking about and why you're asking it on the question. But there's not so much there that it absolutely snows them.
And it's a fine line. I mean, it's a fine line between giving too much information and giving too little information. And it's one that I walk every time I write an article. And I get people who send me emails saying, you know, what you wrote on this one particular topic simply didn't explain it clearly enough to me. And you said, we were talking a few minutes ago, Ted, you said I was too critical of myself. I think that sometimes it can be a fault, but I think it can also be a big advantage. I'll go in when someone says, you know, what you said about, you mentioned Kirchhoff's law before, is what you said about that didn't make any sense. I'll go back and I will read the thing several times for trying to put myself in the mindset of someone who doesn't know much about it, and then ask myself, why is this not getting through? What could I say to make it better? And I'm constantly refining. So Hamtest Online isn't finished. It'll never be finished. I'm making changes to it all the time as I come up with better ways of saying things. But it's a fine line. I mean, I don't want to get into a great deal of detail on that. We're going to let that other line ring through. Sorry about the ding-a-ling sound here. I don't want to go into a lot of detail about something. There's only like 2 or 3 questions on the exam. I don't want to go into, you know, a 5-minute explanation of something. But when people do want more information, a lot of times I'll provide a link if we find another page out there that's got great information on it. Or a lot of times we'll just link to Wikipedia, because Wikipedia has great technical articles. Sometimes, I mean, the Wikipedia articles go, for my taste, they go into way too much depth. But for people who want the more depth, we'll do that. But the question is, when you're studying on my site and it brings up a question about branch currents through circuit, you know, through resistors, and you sort of vaguely remember you saw that article I wrote on it, but you can't remember it because maybe it's been a while, because maybe it's been like a year since you've logged in. If you don't remember, you just click the button down at the bottom of the page, you know, see text, and it brings that text up again, and you can read through it and review it. If it's still not making sense to you, or if you want to understand it in more detail, you can click the link and go to Wikipedia or some other article out there on the web that we've found for you and get some more information. As a general rule, I don't recommend that people spend an awful lot of time following the links because, I mean, bottom line is you're going to be in ham radio for decades. This is like your entry point. You go through, you get the exam, you will have a lot of time to study those particular technical topics that you're interested in a lot more detail. You don't know now, 3 years from now, you might find spread spectrum to be the most interesting thing that you've ever heard of. There's a wealth of information out there, but that doesn't mean you have to necessarily learn it now. Just for now, learn what you need to know to understand the questions and answers, understand what ham radio is about, get that license, get on the air, and then, you know, focus in on what interests you when the... It's all like on-the-job training, in a sense. Yeah, you focus on learning things when you want to know them, when you need to know them, when they're relevant in your own life. That's my point of view on the whole thing.
Well, you know, the thing that I was saying is that you know, a lot of folks, there's two approaches to this. Some folks are just interested in memorizing the answers and being able to pass the test. Others really want to know and understand what it is they're studying. And I think Ham Test Online gives you probably the best of both worlds, because the object in studying to start with is to pass the exam. So that should, that's the focus. But when you walk away from it, you walk away with concepts, I should say, that you didn't have prior to. You now do understand. And I think that what happens is, down the road, you know, you're reading a QST, you're listening to a ham talk on the air, you're online reading something, and all of a sudden, the subject comes up that was part of the study material of Ham Test Online, and you recall that explanation that was given. And then you take the information you're reading in the article, or in a magazine, or online, or in a handbook or some sort, and now all of a sudden, it kind of joins in with what you already know, and now you have even a more complete understanding of what it is that you were studying to start with. Does that hold true, or am I?
No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you're right. It's my goal to sort of give you, and this, the exams are structured to give you sort of a very broad but not very deep introduction into a whole wide variety of topics that altogether comprise amateur radio. I'm going to warn people here, I engage in a little bit of self-teaching. All you want to do is memorize the answers and pass the exam, you don't care about learning anything, you know, the intelligent repetition we have on my site is very effective at doing that. But be aware that I have this own agenda that I'm pushing, and it's maybe subtly, and it's maybe something that I'm going to sneak in, and you may not even realize it's happening. But I'm going to trick you into learning things, even if you don't want to. Because pretty quickly, as you start to use my software, you're going to realize that you can memorize the answers faster and get done a lot faster if you go ahead and read the articles that I'm writing, because the articles have the answers to the questions in them. And if you read the article, and then I ask it to you and you answer it, then you've seen it twice. But be warned, you're going to accidentally, whether you want to or not, you're going to learn something. You're going to come out of this, you're going to know what. So what I was saying was, be warned that I'm going to teach you things whether you want to hear things or not. It's going to be, there's going to be information coming through that you may not particularly care about, but you're going to wind up learning something by accident. And maybe someday down the line you'll actually thank me.
You know, I don't want to switch streams here too quickly, but tell me a little bit about your partner there in Ham Test Online. Let's talk about Pi just for a minute, K1RV, and tell me a little bit about him and his involvement with Ham Test Online.
Pi's one of the nicest guys you will know. He's he's always in a good humor. He's always telling jokes. You undoubtedly realize that he's one of the funniest people I know, which really I appreciate, because I think that life's too short to take it too seriously, and I think you got to enjoy it while you're here. And uh, I've I have the utmost respect for Pi. He got involved in the early days when I first said I thought maybe I told him, hey, I'd loaded the question pools and I'd use that to study. He said, that's great. He's one of the people who said you should put that online, Zealot, and because people would really love to have something like that. And I did, and he's been there supporting me and helping me along the way for all of these years. He's fabulous. I mean, and the great thing is he complements. He and I have pretty much opposite personalities. You know, I think you mentioned before ham radio being somewhat of a schizophrenic hobby. You've got the social aspect, the technical aspect. Well, he's got the social aspect mastered very well, and you know he's not too bad with the technical. And I understand that my bent on things is a lot more technical. I mean, if you're going to be talking to Pi and me, and you want to talk about the best way to sell people who are members of the Fist Club, well, Pi is the guy to talk to. But if you're going to talk to us about the best way to convert between Cartesian and polar coordinates, well, I'd probably be the one that you want to talk to about that particular thing. So we're sort of like two sides of a coin. Opposite personalities combined together has worked out very well for us. I couldn't say enough nice things about Pi. He's involved in everything.
Well, tell me a little bit about his ham radio career. And I know you guys are friends, you've gone back a while, but I didn't know if he was like business partner, or you know, head moral supporter, or how he figured into the scheme of things. I know his picture's on the website, and he was the one that I met originally that had talked to. It was just really, really cranked on Ham Test Online, and came over and talked to us. Brought us some guests over to the booth when we were at Dayton in Huntsville, and you know, really impressed me. So I. Why don't you tell us a little bit about his career in ham radio, if you want to call it a career, but the hobby part of it. And also, I know he's involved in the Ships Online weekend thing. And, you know, tell us a little bit about him and all of his activities.
Okay, well, I understand the story of Pi getting involved in ham radio had something to do with dinosaurs and Marconi, and I don't remember all the details, but bottom line is I think he was licensed before I was born. I think he was licensed at age 11 or something, which was right around the time that I was born. And but he's been, you know, it's been, you talked, Ted, about how there's so many interesting things out there, and I've been very distracted in my life by all sorts of different interesting things, you know, computers and politics, and I just find so many things fascinating. Exercise, I'm a little bit of an athlete, and I find myself very distracted. But Pi has kept this focus on ham radio as being one of the very most important key components of his life for 50 years now, I'm saying. And as for where he stands with the company, technically the company's mine. I own it. I pay the bills, and I pocket the income. But there would be no Ham Test Online today without Pi's moral support and encouragement, and his always being there and standing with me. In terms of business decisions, I rarely make any business decisions without consulting Pi. And as a matter of fact, quite often I'll go with what Pi thinks over what I think, because he's got such a great track record. But there's, you know, with me being as scattered as I am, this thing probably wouldn't be there today if it wasn't for Pi's always being there, supporting me, behind me. In terms of his ham radio career, I mean, he's done, I couldn't even begin to cover his resume to any appreciable degree, but I'll tell you a couple of events that were very important to me. On the 100-year anniversary of the first transatlantic communication, which would have been back, Morse code communication, which was back in, 2004, maybe, something like that?
I have no idea.
I would know the exact day. I think it may have been in December. He put together a special event station that was really stunning. It was down on Cape Cod. It was within just a few miles away from the place where the first transmission actually, where it was received or where it was transmitted. But it was one of the stations involved in this communication, this historic communication. He put together a special event, lasted an entire week. Maybe it was 9 days. I think because it was two. I think it was two full weekends and the intervening week. He had at least 100 people came down and operated. He had like 9 different stations going. We operated on every band. We had I can even begin to describe the amazing things that were going on. It was like the daughter of Marconi was out there, and she was making statements to the press, and it was really a huge, huge hoopla. And that was one of the most exciting special events I worked in. And it was that he did this in a place that was a barracks that belongs to the Coast Guard, and they let us stay there. Although they normally don't let anyone do that, they let us stay there, and there were many people who stayed through the night, and I slept there a couple of nights and did operating. You know, got up at 6 a.m, did operating in the wee hours before. Or 5 a.m. or whatever it was before a lot of people showed up and to take over, and it was really just a super classy, super exciting operation. You know, I can't even begin to tell you how many contacts there were, but it's like all the details of this. He does all of this. I mean, I don't want to say he's the only one involved, but he's sort of like the driving force behind it. He coordinates the efforts of dozens of people to get all the right equipment out and all the right in all the right media contacts and all the right press releases and all the stuff that's got to get done. And this is just one of many, many, many things he's done. One time we had a special event at Boston Light, which is the world's, which is America's oldest continuously operating, continuously manned lighthouse. It's been in operation and manned since, like, I don't know, 17-something or other. I don't know the exact date. And no one ever is allowed to stay overnight on the island. And yet, Ty, somehow or another, because he's a super friendly guy and he's got all the right social skills, he talked somebody into getting special permission to let a group of us stay overnight. And we worked all night at Boston Light. And then that lighthouse is one that is very rarely operated and was very, very much appreciated by the lighthouse hunters. And those are the types of things he did. He was one of the driving forces. I don't know if he was the one or just one of a team that was the driving forces behind the creation of the Museum Ships Weekend event, which is now, of course, an annual event and involves, I think, somewhat over 100 ships are involved in it now. But in the beginning, it was Pi and a small group of his friends that put the whole thing together.
Well, I guess another thing that has entered my mind and I wonder about, okay, Pi is not his real name, but I'm curious, do you know about the name Pi, where it came from, and why he uses that as the moniker that he does?
Yeah, it's not a pretty story, actually. Not sure. I mean, he tells people freely, so he feels a little embarrassed about it now. When he was a kid, he was a bit of a brat, as you can imagine. And when he was in high school, he and a bunch of friends used to go to a convenience store where there was a guy who, I guess, had some sort of a speech impediment, and he sounded a bit like a pirate. And everybody called this guy the pirate. And Pi is being the bratty guy he is, he used to make fun of this guy, behind his back, and people started calling him the pirate, and then it got shortened to just calling him Pi. So it's not that he was a math genius and he knew 100 decimal places of pi. That's me. I was a math genius. But he was the one who wound up with a nickname. But it was really mostly because he was, a bratty, spoiled child. But, it's hard to get mad at him because he's such a pleasant guy. He doesn't have a mean bone in his body. And it's even hard for me to imagine him doing that because, kids will be kids, I guess.
That's incredible. It says something here. I was looking on QRZ. But, we were talking about like Hamtest Online is, once again, that's part of the marriage of computers and amateur radio. But the thing that I think that has, obviously now, is part of amateur radio culture that will go down in history as part of amateur radio culture, and that's QRZ. Yeah. It was very, very interesting in hearing the originator and owner of QRZ talking about being off somewhere and listening to the radio and hearing some guy out in the Pacific say, "Oh, I'm good on QRZ." And you know, he said it just hit him all of a sudden, you know, like, "Whoa, wait a minute. You know, I'm good on I'm good on QRZ, you know." So that's, you know, the thing is that this culture that we're talking about. So about computers, and I was just looking, matter of fact, just looking on QRZ, looking up Pi's Call, which is K1RV. And it says, "I was first licensed in March of 1962 as KN1VXB at the age of 13. I spent the year operating on 80, 40, and 15 meters in CW with an ICO 720, which I remember that CW transmitter. Also operated 2-meter AM using a Gonset box, obviously. Upgraded to a general class March 1963, added an ICO 730 modulator to my station, and used an NFED ZEP antenna, had a rotatable dipole for 15 meters. I enjoyed rag chewing and started working a bit of DX. Much of my operating had been confined to being crystal controlled. And I was very pleased to add a Heathkit VF1 VFO, even though it had a drift." It goes on a little bit more, talks about, but that's very interesting to hear his beginnings. You know, it's interesting to note, you know, he had a CW transmitter to start with and then acquired a tube modulator for it, you know, which is that, you know, ancient stuff. And
we all started out as novices, didn't we?
For the most part, I think everybody started off as a novice. Some people started out in Citizens Band, you know, and then became a novice, you know. But, yeah, I think everyone, back then, everyone had a novice license. And, of course, the technician now, yeah, I think, is the today's equivalent of someone getting a novice ticket. But, of course, the novice license was limited to CW only. And unless you were on 2 meters, you didn't talk at all. You were just strictly on CW. But that was really magic. I remember coming home from school and flipping on the radio, you know, and
yep,
and wanting, I mean, I wasn't trying to earn a certificate. I just wanted all the QSL cards I could get my hands on.
yep.
So, well, now, you know, okay, let's talk just a little bit now. I mean, before we run along here and run out of time, let's talk just a little bit about Hamtest Online. Now, and the reason I'm bringing this up, once again, I just want to let folks know, you know, this is not an infomercial, and this is this is not a paid commercial. Anyway, I'm doing this. I've got John on here to talk about Hamtest Online because I want to see people get tickets. I want to see shortwave listeners be able to go get their ham license. Those guys that have been putting it off for so long, saying, "Oh, I think I may do this." Don't think about it anymore. Just go sign up. Now, the thing that I think is shocking, we hear about this program learning and all this that's been put into it. This has got to be the most economical thing I've ever heard of in my life. I mean, it is really economical. Tell the folks, if you would, what it costs, because this is part of it, what it costs to sign up to Hamtest Online and how, you know, what the cost is and how long the, once they sign up, you know, how long it's good for.
Okay. We are doing a special now. We've been doing it for a while and probably will continue it for a while. For the introductory level license, which is the technician license, which is where everybody has to start, our course is $20. Now, let me put it into perspective for people. If you went out and bought, the old traditional way of getting ready is to study with the license manual. If you went out and bought the license manual, that license manual is $29.95 now, plus tax, plus shipping. Last I checked, they wanted for ground shipping, they wanted something like $10. So you're looking at $40 to get the book shipped to you. The book is full of good information, and it will get you your license. But the software, at half that price, has the information you need to know to pass the exam. It also has built in the Cyber Tutor, which is intelligent repetition that we were talking about earlier, which keeps track of your progress, focuses on your weak areas, and makes sure that you're prepared for passing the exam. The other thing we have is the money-back guarantee. If you fail the exam, or if you're unhappy with the software for any reason, we'll refund your money. And the only limitation we put on that refund is that you have to ask for it within 2 years of when you sign up. So any time within the two-year period after you purchase this, you can get an absolute 100% full refund, no matter what your reasoning is. So overall, I think it's a pretty good deal. We do that because the computer-aided learning, the programmed learning you're talking about, is so effective that once people have tried it, they love it, and virtually no one asks for a refund. Our refund rate's less than 1%. It's effective, and it's because it's pleasant.
I can't imagine anybody wanting a refund, but nonetheless. Okay, now let's just say that they're wanting to study for the general, or they want to upgrade to the extra. What's the cost on that?
Well, now is when we start to actually get pricey, because we figure by this time, people have already figured out that this is really a great way to study. So that's when we crank back up to our regular prices. The general course is $29.95, which is the same price as the ARRL license manual. Well, of course, there's no shipping and tax, so it actually turns out to be a little cheaper to study online. But the extra class is our biggest one, our hardest one, and most complex. The most work went into developing it. And for that one, we get $34.95. Still less than that manual is going to be once you include shipping and taxes. But, you know, they go ahead and they get on up there, right up into the same type of price range as the books do, because they have as much value as the books do. I like to think they have more value than the books because of the cyber tutor.
So, I mean, and so if you sign up for the, let's just say the person signs up for the extra. Now, they can come in and still take the technician, then study for the general, and then study for the extra. In other words, this is...
Not really. No, not exactly. Okay. I mean, our courses are sold separately. If you sign up for the extra, the only materials you're going to get access to are the extra. If you have a general and you feel like you need the review, my suggestion to you is you probably do not need the review, that we will be able to get you from wherever you are up to extra. You will find that you remember more that you had learned on the general exam that then you think you would, that you don't need to. But if you really did want to go back and study the materials for technician in general, you would have to actually buy those courses. We did not bundle it any. We used to bundle it all together. We don't do that anymore.
Okay, well, I recall it being bundled, but it doesn't make any sense as a rule because most people are pretty targeted. They know what class license they want to get.
Right, and that's all you need. I do not recommend. I never try to sell people. You know, I'll get people who say, "Well, I've got the general, but I don't remember anything about it. I think I need to start from scratch." I mean, I'll let them do it if they want to, but you know, it's going to cost you $75 if you're going to buy all three courses, and you don't need to do that. All you need to do, if you're at general, you want to go to extra, because it's not like we just say. Well, we showed you this for general, we're not going to show it to you on the extra. You're going to get some sort of go back more from a review point of view. I mean, we may not go back. We're not going to go back and teach you Ohm's Law, but you've seen it before, and you pick it up from context for the most part. You don't need to go back and review the earlier courses.
Okay, now, let me just say this. If a person goes through the whole thing and they wind up with the extra class license, the maximum that they can incur is $75, is what you're saying. I mean, that's it for everything. In other words, if you went from technician, then to general, and then to extra. Now, the thing I was going to point out, though, and that is if a person is stuck and they just can't quite figure it out. In other words, they're taking the test and they're saying, "I don't understand this. This doesn't make any sense to me."
Yeah.
What do you offer for that individual?
Well, officially, we don't really offer anything. It's an online course. It is what it is. But the practical matter is, we have my phone number is published, and I answer the phone on an as available basis for about 80 hours a week. So from anywhere from 5 a.m. to 5 p.m. Pacific time, 7 days a week. If I'm home, which I am 90% of the time, and if I'm not on the phone with somebody else, I will pick up the phone, or if you leave a message, I will call you back, and I'll help people through things. You know, people say, "Well, I'm really having trouble understanding the whole concept of you know, whatever it is. And I, you know, near incidence vertical propagation. Although I think my article and that's pretty good. So I will talk them through it. I will explain the things they don't understand. A lot of times it'll come down to math. I had a guy who was studying for the extra, and he called me Thursday or Friday, and his problem had to do with one of the problems where there was a 1% feed line loss, and he was trying to figure out how the math had worked. And I basically brought up the same thing on my screen that he'd see on his screen, which explains it all, and I sort of talked him through it. And then, you know, I got like a third of the way through the explanation, and all of a sudden, you know, dawn, the light bulb goes on. He goes, oh, I get it. I know what I missed before. I didn't understand what you were saying here. I just didn't see where this number comes from, but I see it now. Now it makes perfect sense. Well, I'll talk to people. I'll explain it, but I'm not trying to say that this is a course with a mentor or instructor or anything like that, because I would say 98% of the people never ask me a technical question. They go through it. It's all online. Everything you need should be there. I mean, occasionally I'll get an email from someone who says, you need to explain this better, and sometimes they're right, and then I'll go around and I'll turn up and I'll explain it better. But pretty much everything you need, it's there already.
Well, I'll tell you something. We're out of time, and this has been pleasant. John, once again, our guest, John Cunningham, W1AI. He's with Ham Test Online. John, tell the folks about the website. Give us the web address and any other information you've got that they may need in order to find you on the Internet.
Okay, the website is called Ham Test Online. Ham as in ham radio, test as in, you know, like exam, and online is where you will find us. And the URL that you can go to is hamtestonline.com. Now, the website offers courses to help prepare you to take the ham radio exam. Some people hear the URL, hamtestonline.com, and they think, oh, you're offering the test online. We cannot do that. FCC does not allow it. They require you to actually show up in person at an exam session, show an ID, and have someone monitor and supervise and make sure that you're not cheating. We can't do that online, so it's really just a matter of us teaching you the materials and getting you prepared that you will definitely pass the exam. Hamtestonline.com, and what else did you want to say? What else did you want me to tell them about it?
Just,
let me just give the very, very brief. It's got the information that you need to know to understand the questions and the answers. It starts at the very, very beginning and builds up logically, one concept building on the other. It has a cyber tutor that keeps track of your progress, and it repeats questions, especially focusing in on the ones where you're weak, and it has a money-back guarantee. If you fail the exam, we will refund your money, or if you decide for some reason this is not the way you want to study, or for any reason you're dissatisfied with our website, we refund your money. But don't count on that, because we get about a 1% refund rate.
We're out of time. I thank you so much. John Cunningham, W1AI, Ham Test Online. He's been our guest today on QSO. We'll have to have you back again. And as time moves on, things change. We'll want more information. John, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ted. It was my pleasure. I'd be happy to be on your show anytime. Thanks for all you've done.